greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know, when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA, or the EPA, or the State Tax Commission, zoning and planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do. And the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about this thing called private business. No, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. And best of all, it's free. So you can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine to request your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, children, we are reviewing a book called Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. Out of this book, there's 315 things that you're not supposed to know about 17 subject matters, things that we like to keep personal and private. You know, I'm a businessman, and as a businessman, there's certain things that we keep personal and private from our customers. And one of the things that you probably have been propagandized into believing is that it's the duty of business to hire people. That employment is some kind of a sacred holy altar, and that management and business is somehow charged with employing more and more people. And I wanted to tell you that that's a poppycock. If I could run my business with no employees, I would do that. And the only reason that any business has any employees whatsoever, any one crummy employee, is because they need that employee to produce the goods and services that they produce and sell. There's no other reason for an employee. So if we can automate your job, if we can build a machine that will do what you do, then you're going to be unemployed. And all that means is that you have to go out into the marketplace and sell your services to somebody that needs what you do in some other capacity. Now, it doesn't make any difference whether you're 25 and you've been outsourced, or you're 55 and your job has been moved to China, or if you're 75 years old and you need to go back to work again. You know, there's work out there. You may not have a job making buggy whips. The buggy whip industry went out with the advent of the automobile. But with the advent of the automobile, then there were hubcap makers, and then there were, you know, upholsterers that needed to upholster all these seats and all these cars. There's all kinds of other jobs. Now, as the industry grows and as technology develops, those jobs are robotized. And so you find that it took so many employees so many hours to build a car in 1920. It takes fewer employees and less hours today to build a car than it did in 1920. And as a result of that, the people that were working at certain jobs and employments in 1920 are no longer doing those jobs and are no longer employed in 2006. I mean, that's just, it's life. It's the way things are. Here on the farm, we used to put up hay loose. And it was a hard, back-breaking job, and it was it required certain skills to put hay up loose. And somebody invented a baler. And you could get more hay into less space. When you put hay in the barn loose, that takes up about three times as much space as baled hay. And then somebody invented a big round baler. And now, you know, if you said to me, Gordon, we've got 3,000 bales of hay, little bales, you know, the little small 40-pound bales, I'd say, well, I don't feed 40-pound bales. I feed half-ton bales. I feed big round bales. And why is that? Labor saving. It's labor saving. And because of that, the guys that were out here bucking bales, you know, 40, 50 years ago, like I did, are no longer employed. And that's because if we can figure out a way to get rid of you, I don't need your services, we'll do that. Now, years ago, they used to milk cows by hand. Then somebody invented a milking machine. And today, all cows are milked by milking machines. And so all the milkers are unemployed. That's technology. Today, the outsourcing of jobs to China and India is simply a continuation of what you're doing or were doing when you invented milking machines and McCormick reapers and the assembly line production. Now, today, you've been educated, and you know that when you want a job, you fill out a resume, and you mail out these resumes. And employment agencies and personnel people will tell you that your experience and credentials are non-transferable. So unless you stay away from the conventional system, that's where I left off last time, this conventional system, it's almost certain that you're going to get absolutely nowhere. Now, you're 40 years old, and you want a career change. It's easy enough to do. Decide what you want to do and get out and get after it. But if you follow this conventional system, you are going to be disappointed. Now, the usual reaction of people who are trying to change careers or jobs is to simply to keep on trying. So if they send out 1,000 resumes that don't work, then they send out 3,000 resumes. Well, boys and girls, if 1,000 resumes don't work, what makes you think that 3,000 are going to work any better? By the time these people realize that this isn't getting any results, they're in a syndrome of rejection and depression. And once you get into that syndrome of rejection and depression, which is a self-defeating cycle, it's very difficult to escape it. And we have millions of people here in America who are unemployed, out of a job, out of unemployment insurance, and they don't know what to do next. I don't know if they're on welfare or living with mom and dad or whatever the hell it is, but boys and girls, there's a need out there for a lot of things. And as old Henry Kaiser said, and I mentioned this last time, find a need and fill it. Because if there's no need, you're not going to fill that job. And so as this outsourcing becomes more and more common, as we have more and more slave labor in China, then you're going to have to quit doing the slave labor jobs here in the United States. Because if some guy in China is willing to work for $2 a day, it's going to be hard for you to make $200 a day doing that same job here in the United States. That's where reality's at. And any employer that can get a job done anywhere else cheaper is going to do that. I would do it right here. If I could hire a guy for $5 an hour, I would replace you, a guy I'm paying $10 an hour, for it with the guy that I can pay five. Now, unions have created monopolies here in the labor market in the United States, which has put the labor market out of sync with reality. And you can't compete here in the United States with $20 labor on jobs that can be done in Mexico for two. That's just where it's at. Now, here's the right approach. Don't even think about looking for a job through employment agencies or personnel departments, sending out resumes or answering newspaper ads. Decide beforehand to forget that route. Do you get that? Newspaper ads. Forget that. Employment agencies. Don't even consider it. Sending out resumes to all these people that don't read them anyway. Now, listen, kids, I'm an old-timey employer. Now, let me tell you what employers want. Results. 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 You got that down? That's all your employer cares about is results. Now, he's willing to pay for those results because the results translate into sales and sales translate into profits. This is why I like to work by piece rate. I like to pay a guy not how many dollars an hour this guy thinks he's worth, but I want to pay him for how many heads of lettuce he can put in the box. I want to pay this guy for how many feet of fence he can actually produce. So when you walk in and you say, I'll wash all of your windows in here for $75, you know, you could sit there and count the windows, or you could sit there and count the square feet in those windows, but you know, you're sitting there saying, well, I'm paying $150 to somebody to wash these windows, and this guy will do it for half that. Let's see what kind of a job he does. Now, if he does a poor job, or he only washes one side of the windows and he's got streaks all over him, we don't want this guy back here at any price, because we don't get results. But when you have two guys that can produce the same results, then we're only interested in the price of achieving those results. So tuck that one away in your heart. What an employer is looking for is results. Now, what if you're in the position that you're the only guy around here who can produce these results? Now, let me show you a real wild example. I had a student in here one time. He's an engraver. This is the guy who could work for the U.S. Mint, and he could engrave the dies to make nickels or dimes or quarters. This is the guy that makes those dies that turn out the $100 bills. He's an engraver. Now, engravers are a rare breed. There's not very many of them around. And while there might be a lot of engravers that can do some engraving, the people that can do the quality of work that turn out $100 bills are very rare. In fact, this guy, when I asked him the question, how many are there? He said, well, there's Bill in Seattle, and there's Tom in Phoenix, and there's Sam in Dallas, and I mean, you could name the engravers in the United States on two hands. That's how rare these guys are. They're artists. You know, it's like how many Michelangelos are there. So when this guy had a controversy with a big company that he was turning out these dies for, he said to them, I want to be paid in $20 double eagles. I want to be paid in $20 gold pieces. And this big corporation in Boston said, like hell, you're going to get paid in $20 double eagles. You're going to get paid with a check like everybody else. And he said, okay. I have some work that's on my bench that I'm doing for you. And when I complete that work, I'm not doing any more for you. And I guess they thought about it over the weekend, because this was between Friday and Tuesday. And the following Tuesday, they called him down Tampa, and they said, Tampa, Florida, and they said, where do we get $20 double eagles? Now, that's finding a need and filling it. And the need for engravers is out there, and there's not very many of them out there. Now, there's lots of people out there that mow grass, and that's why mowing grass doesn't pay as much as engraving plates to make $100 bills. Now, think of yourself as a product that you have to market. And if you've been in management, you've been trained, and you are experienced in analyzing your company's problems. This is the time to use those abilities in analyzing your own situation. And that's called marketing yourself. Now, everybody who works, I'm a worker, and I have to market my schools. I have to market myself. I have to sell my product, my service. So I don't send out resumes to people and say, well, would you hire me to be a college law teacher? I mean, I don't want to work up here as a law teacher at the university. There's no money in that. And any law school teacher will tell you that. I mean, any teacher will tell you there's no money in teaching. Now, what you're looking for is a little small private business, a little niche market over here that you can appeal to, that you can make your living at. And you want to make a good living. You want to make more than the average Chinese guy over here working for $2 a day. So you need to do the research and develop, or the research and development on yourself. You must figure out who you are, what your skills are, and what it is that you really want to do. You're going to do a better job and succeed at something that you like, something that's of interest to you. This should include considerations such as where you want to live and intermediate goals versus long-term goals. Do you want to live in Alaska? I mean, you know, you might move up to Alaska and go to work on the North Slope and just hate that place. And that's a pretty nasty place to try to make a living. Now, yeah, they'll pay you pretty well to go up there, but, you know, are you going to be there for the next 10, 15, 20 years? Are you going to make a career of it? Are you going to be successful at it? Or are you going to be there for 6 months and then pull out? So you want to consider where you want to live. You know, I live where I live because this is where I want to live. And if I wanted to live in Florida, I could live in Florida and run this radio program and run my school nearly any place that I want to be. That's the advantage of planning ahead and then saying to yourself, I want to live in Missouri. I want to live in California. I do not want to live in Washington. I do not want to live in this place or that place or some other place. You know, decide where you want to live. Now, what do you want to do when you get there? You see yourself as a whole person with skills, interests, and goals that may have nothing to do with your past employment. Now, be specific. A vague goal, such as I'd like to be a teacher, is totally meaningless. I want to teach music. I want to teach law. I want to teach science. I want to teach in the high school level in San Francisco. You know, if you want to be a science teacher and you want to live in San Francisco, then you want to be a high school teacher in San Francisco, California. That's a pretty specific goal. Now, what do you need to do to get there? You got to do the market research for yourself and find out exactly who would be interested in the product that you're selling. Now, how do you do that? Well, you need to talk to people and find out what's available in your area of interest. Don't look for a job. Simply survey the situation and find out what the needs are. So Henry Kaiser said, find a need and fill it. Is there a need for science teachers in the high school system in San Francisco, California? I remember one time I'd been laid off of a job, and I rode in a carpool, and the guys, the other three guys in the carpool, you know, when they heard that I was laid off, you know, they said, oh my God. I remember Phil Delarivas, 53 years old, he said, if I lost my job, I don't know what I would do. Now, at the time, I was in my 20s, so, you know, I was looking for a job when I found that one. But, you know, I lost my job, and I'm out now looking for another job. And there was something that I was really interested in, and it was shipbuilding. I wanted to work in a shipyard. But at that time, the Todd Shipyards had just laid off 6,000 workers in Alameda, California, another 6,000 shipyard workers out in the marketplace looking for a job. And so I said, well, I'm going to hire myself a job, and I did at Pacific Coast Engineering down near the Park Street Bridge. And I decided I wanted to work there, and by God, I went to work there. I went to work there as a fitter. Now, that's called selling yourself a job. Now, there was need for fitters. There's need for people that want to work. There's work for people that can produce results. Now, if you just want to stand there leaning on a shovel, drawing a paycheck, you know, you're going to have a problem. I mentioned that to you last time. Americans suffer from the terminal lazies. Now, if you want to get out there and work, produce results, there's an employer out there for you, because I'm an employer, and I could put anybody to work producing results. Results is what sells. Employment doesn't sell. Simply hiring people, putting them on the job doesn't sell. Having people standing around leaning on shovels doesn't make any profit. Standing at the water cooler pinching the girls on the butt doesn't make the company any money. Sending emails and puttering around in your little cubicle over here doing your own personal work doesn't make the company any money. Now let me give you one more example here of results. I went to work for a guy one time, an old Portuguese guy named Frank Rocha. He didn't have irrigation, and so therefore he depended upon clipping his fields. He had three employees, three guys milking, and he hired me. I was the third guy. He had 140 cows, not a very efficient operation by today's standards, but that was normal for those days, maybe a little less than normal. And I went to work there, and as a 15-year-old kid, there was nothing, you know, more exciting than driving tractors. So, you know, I was a 15-year-old kid. I couldn't get enough driving. And so he was behind on the clipping, and so I went down there in the fields, and I clipped all night long. I got through milking. I jumped on the tractor at 10 o'clock, and I went down there and clipped all night long. 4 o'clock in the morning, I brought the cows up. Now, nobody else, no, normal people in their right minds, you know, don't do things like that. They go to bed, they go out and on the town, they're out honky-tonking, chasing girls, and having a good time. And I'm down here working. Now, that ranked pretty high on the boss's list of achievements. And it developed results. And so I caught up on all of that clipping. That fall, and now in the wintertime, he only kept one man. So he had three men from about March through November, and then December, January, February, 3 months in the wintertime, he'd have one man. Guess who the one man was that he kept that year? 1955-56, it was me. And I was a school kid driving to school, so he kept me. And I could work with Frank part-time, go to school full-time, and produce the same results as any other hired man. Now, that was hard work. I had to hustle. And I did. But the point is that I'm the guy that kept the job, and I was the guy that got the employment. Now, he paid me more. I got regular bonuses, high marks, and I was the guy that was kept, and the other guys were let go. And I was the least skilled guy there, but I got in there and I hustled. And I'm here to tell you as an employer that that's what employers are looking for. They're looking for a guy that gets in there and hustles. You get to work early and you leave late. Union jobs aren't for those kind of people. The union doesn't want you to get there early and leave late. The union doesn't want you to work, bust your ass, and produce. And that's what the employer wants. And if he's got union help, that's not a place where you're going to find opportunity. Opportunity is where you can produce more than anybody else and get paid for it. And I'm that kind of guy. I'm the kind of guy that says, if I can pick 10 boxes of lettuce and I make $3 a box, I get 30 bucks a day. But if I could figure out a way to produce twice as much, then I want to get paid twice as much. Now, they go on to point out that meet with contacts. Personnel and business contacts are all important. Or personal and business contacts are all important. You'll make some contacts while surveying your interest area. But don't hesitate to survey friends, relatives, or current business associates. Ask around. Hey, Bob, what's going on in your field? Hey, what is there any jobs down there? I'm looking for a job. Go with your heart and radiate enthusiasm about your goal. A positive attitude is crucial and comes only from doing what you really want to do, not what you think you should do, or what seems sensible, or what someone else wants you to do. If your proposal turns on you, it'll have the same effect as your potential buyers. Now let me show you something. I wanted to learn how to set chokers in the woods. I wanted to go to work in the woods. I went to an employment agent and agency, and they sent me out to Bowman and Brown in Alder Point, California. When I got out there, the guy says, well, we only want experienced choker setters. We don't want people that don't know how to do this job. Now, from Eureka to Alder Point is probably 60, 70 miles, and some of it's over some rough road. Last thing I want to do is go back to the employment agency looking for a job. I think I was about 18 years old, maybe. I think I was out of high school. And I was standing there in this guy's office and said, no, I'm sorry, son, we're not hiring unskilled guys. We got to have somebody that's experienced. So I said, well, listen, now that I'm here, why don't I work for you free? He looked at me like I was Mork from Mork. I had to be suffering from the terminal stupids. I said, yeah, no, I don't blame you. I understand your position. You don't want to pay me $2.50 an hour to stand around on, holding a shovel and don't know what to do with it. So if you'll teach me choker setting, I will work for you free until such time as I learn how to do the job to the standards that you expect, and then I expect you to pay me. He was dumbfounded. To think that somebody would work free, like an apprentice. And so he couldn't make the decision, so he went and talked to Larry Brown, the owner. And Brown came out of his office. He walked over and he said, Phil tells me that you're looking for a job and you're willing to work for nothing. He said, what the hell's the matter with you? And I said, well, what's the matter with me is my lack of skills. I don't have the skills that you need in your job, in your employment. And in order for me to develop those skills, somebody has to teach me, you know? Everybody has to learn. You were not born knowing how to set chokers. Somebody had to teach you. That was true of Phil. It was true of Larry. It was true of me and anybody else. Somebody had to teach you. And I want you to teach me, and I'll work free until I learn how. And when I learn how, you pay me. And you pay me what you think I'm worth. I was hired on the spot. Pimply-faced, punk kid, hired on the spot. He said, take him out there, Phil, and put him behind a cat, teach him how. So I went to work, and I worked for the week. And at the end of the week, in those days, if you couldn't learn a skill, a job in a week, obviously you weren't cut out for that. So I got in there, and I busted my butt. And at the end of the week, I was a fair to middle and choker setter. And at the end of the week, they paid me for the week. They didn't hold back any pay. They said, anybody that's willing to work and get out there and learn how, we want them. And I'm here to tell you, boys and girls, if you'll work like that, there's no reason why. I'd hire you in the morning if you'd work like that. Guy walks up to me and says, I'll work for you free. Teach me how to do that. Then you pay me what you think I'm worth. That's a valuable employee. Now, you're not getting paid because you're setting chokers. You're getting paid for how many logs you can put on the landing. And I could put as many logs on the landing as anybody else there. And in fact, I could put more logs on the landing than anybody else there at the end of a week. More than anybody else. But that's what hard work does. And that's what every employer is looking for. He didn't care how old you are. He didn't care if you're 99 years old. If you're 90 years old and you can put more logs on the landing than anybody else, he's going to hire you. Over the 18 or 25-year-old kid, I don't care who or what the employer is. The employer is only concerned about results. Always remember that, results. If you can produce the results, you get the job. Now, you have to be able to convince that guy that you're able to produce those results. That means that you got to sell yourself. And so, as I just pointed out, how are you going to put yourself in the boss's position? Okay, I don't know how to do that, but I want to learn how. And he says to himself, do I want to spend my time teaching this guy? I'll work free. Well, how can the boss lose if you're going to work free? Those are the kinds of little neat stories here in this book called Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. I editorialized and put in a couple of stories here from my own personal experience, but I'm an old-timey employer, and I'm telling you what I'm looking for, and these people are telling you, you can be a high school science teacher in San Francisco, California. Maybe you can't get into the public school system. Do you ever stop and think about the Baptist or the Catholic schools? What do you know about science? How can you teach science unless you know something about science? Now, I'm a law school teacher, and I think I could probably teach law in any school in America. That doesn't mean that every school in America or any school in America is going to hire me. I'm an old man. I don't teach the same kind of conventional law in the same kind of conventional format that they teach in the conventional law schools. And so they probably don't want me. But hey, listen, I'll bet you there's somebody out there that wants me. But I've got to go sell myself, and I've got to go show them, here's what I do, and here's what I can do. Here's what I'm going to do for you, and here's how you're going to profit from that. Now, here's one more last little kicker over here. If somebody hires you for $10 an hour, you have to produce 20, bare minimum. You've got to produce 20. If you can only produce $15 an hour, you can't get 10, because the guy that hires you has to make as much off of you as he pays you. That's the rule of thumb. The guy that hires you for $10 an hour is going to make $10 an hour off of your labor, or he's not going to have you around. Doesn't need you. I told the guy that the other day. I said to him, listen, partner, if I have to go around behind you and fix up what it is you screw up, I don't need you. I'll just go do it myself and do it right the first time. So you got to be able to do it right the first time, but you got to be able to do it fast enough and efficiently enough that you're making the boss as much. If you want $30 an hour, I don't care. I would pay a guy $30 an hour in a heartbeat. If he's making me $60, I'll pay you $100 an hour. If you're making $200, no, just use your head. The guy that hires you is making as much as you are. And if he's not making as much as you are off of the labor that you produce, then he doesn't need you. And he isn't going to hire you. Now, that's the way the cookie crumbles, and that's the way that game is played. So if you think you're worth $20 an hour, then you better be able to produce 40. Or you better lower your sights, or you better increase your skills until you can do that $40 an hour worth of production. And I'll guarantee you this, if you can produce $40 an hour, there isn't anybody that isn't going to hire you. Nobody is going to pass up that profit. Well, nobody that I know of. There might be some silly fools out there. Hey, listen, I got to give you the mid-course reminder here that the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you timely reports now on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. And that the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements and recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed necessarily in whole by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, though, are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. But they should. They should. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and the school is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page at the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call direct, 417-273-4967, and ask for it. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, there's a lot of neat stories in here about your career and your business. And 28 things, as a matter of fact. 28 neat little stories in here about career and business. And then they get on to estate and retirement planning. Boy, that's a big one. Estate and retirement planning. 10 things that you ought to know. Starts over here on page 93. Let me flip over to page 93. No, I didn't retire. I'm 68 years old. I'm not on Social Security. I dropped out of Social Security back in 1984. I stopped paying in 78. And I don't think Social Security is the third rail of politics. I don't want Social Security. I don't want unemployment insurance and workman's compensation. There's 108 benefits that you get from Social Security. Most people don't know that there's 108 benefits that they receive or could receive or potentially could receive from Social Security. And if they could, they'd probably be out there trying to get on the dole and trying to get those benefits. The truth of the matter is there's more money to be made in private business than there is in welfare and the dole. So I'm not interested in it. But many of you are, and many of you people want to retire, and you're all excited about retirement and so on. And so they got a section in here on estate and retirement planning. So before I get into that, I want to tell you a little story here. I just got this off of Magombo. I think I mentioned this to you the other day. That if you wanted to retire for 20 years, you're going to retire at age 65, you're going to die when you're 85, so you got to plan for 20 years. If you'd have started in 1966, preparing for retirement in the year 2006, you needed to save 50% of everything that you created and produced from 1966 to the year 2006. In order for you to retire for 20 years at that 1966 level. Which isn't very likely, because for the 20 years from 2006 to 2026, inflation is cooking at 10% right now. And it's surely going to cook at the same 4.9% that it did from 66 to 2006. Now, how many of you people can save 50% of everything you create and produce for 40 years so that you can retire for 20? Well, I couldn't do it. I couldn't. So, as a result of that, here I am 68 years old, and I'm still working full-time. Every day I get up, and I come out here, and I go to work, or I'm out in the field working with my cows or sheep or building fence or doing something. And then I'm going to continue doing that until I can't work anymore, until I'm all stove up and can't get up in the morning or bedridden or something. Now, I'm not going to be disappointed in doing that because I'm still making enough money to, make my $8,400 a year so that I can make ends meet. And as a result of that, I'm happy and I'm in good health and I'm paying my bills and so on. Now, people that are retired right now are complaining. Or people who were planning on retirement, and they find out that United Airlines just aced them out of their retirement, or Delta Airlines just screwed them out of their retirement, or something else, which is in the cards, because all of the major corporations are going to scrap their retirement programs. Now, you can sit there and say, well, that's immoral, or that's a breach of trust, or that's a breach of promise. Well, maybe it is, but that's what's happening, and it's what's going to continue to happen. You can bet on it. So, here are some facts that you're not supposed to know about estate and retirement planning. You're not supposed to know this, but, we're going to share it with you. You need to arithmetic. There's some arithmetic to do before you retire. Can you count? Here's how to size up your financial situation. First of all, you need to list your assets and include income-producing assets like stocks, bonds, annuity-generating insurance policies, and real estate. Company profit-sharing plans, plus non-income-producing assets, paid-up life insurance, furniture and household goods, and assets that require expenditures for maintenance of houses and cars, and then estimate the total dollar value factoring in appreciation. Two, figure out post-retirement income, add up income from assets, pensions, and Social Security, then calculate your post-retirement expenses. This is number three. Calculate your post-retirement expenses, and then deduct the costs stemming from work, commuting, clothes. Next, add on the cost of benefits like health insurance that will no longer be covered by an employer. Estimate an annual dollar factor, and then factor in the inflation rate. I just did that for you, 4.9% from 1966 to 2006. If your post-retirement, number four, if your post-retirement expenses outstrip post-retirement income, then you need to develop a plan for liquidating assets. Rule of thumb. The percentage of total capital that a retired person may spend annually begins at 5% at age 65 and increases by 1% every 5 years. At age 80, it is 10%. The amount of money that you spend annually increases as you get older. Isn't that just special? Because as you get sicker and older, it costs more money to have those nurses come and take care of you. So instead of retiring at age 62 or age 65, my conclusion was that I don't have enough money to retire and maintain my standard of living. So do I want to take a cut in my standard of living? And my conclusion was no. No, I don't. The other day I taught a class down in Austin, Texas. Now, if I was retired, I couldn't do that. It costs money to go to Austin, Texas. It costs money to stay in that hotel. You know, and I wanted to do that, and so in order for me to do that, I have to be working. I couldn't do that if I was retired. And I like my farm, and I like my cattle, and I like my sheep, and I can't afford to do that if I'm retired. So, in order for me to afford the things that I like and want to do, then I have to keep working. So, I've decided to do that. Now, unless you're in a very small minority, I mentioned a guy last program, I think, or program before, a guy by the name of Henry. In his lifetime, now he's as old as I am, same age as I am. He's 68 years old. He's retired now. But in his lifetime, he built seven houses. He has six houses rented out. He's living in the seventh one. So when he got out of high school back in 1957, he went to work as an electrician's apprentice. So from 57 to 61, he did his apprenticeship. And in 1961, he became a journeyman electrician. He worked as a journeyman electrician from 1961 to 2002. He developed union benefits in retirement. He developed Social Security retirement. But more importantly, he built seven houses out of his income. He paid cash. So back in the 60s, when he built a house, it probably cost him $15,000, $20,000. And he built the house and rented it out. And then in 1970, it probably cost him double that. 1980s, he built another house or two. He built a total of seven houses from 1961 through 2002. How many years is that? 40 years. Built seven houses in 40 years. Or about two houses every 10 years. About one house every 5 years. He built a house. Now he owns those houses free and clear, and they rent for, I don't know what they rent for, but I imagine $1,000 a month or more. So he has a retirement income of $6,000 a month. He's living in a house that he's bought and paid for, that he's not making any payments on. Plus he has Social Security. Plus he has his union retirement. And then in addition to that, he might have something else I don't know about. That guy can afford to retire. He can afford to quit working because he's got a retirement income. But what do you do if you didn't build six or seven houses? I didn't build six or seven houses. Didn't have the foresight to do that. Or whatever. And so here I am. Now I got to keep on working. And I see people down at Walmart doing the same thing. They were down at Walmart greeting people at the door. You know, they're 75 years old and had to come out of retirement and go do something to make a little money to tide them over, pay the rent. Now, there are some joint ownership traps and then winning retirement spots. And they point out that there are some places, you know, that are cheaper to live here in the country than there are than other places. Now, this guy happens to live in California, which is one of the highest priced states in the country. But he has a retirement income. He can afford to live there. Now, for instance, they point out a number of states here, and they give you a little overview about what it costs. You know, Kerrville, with a population of 19,000, that's Kerrville, Texas. Kerrville is in the Texas Hill Country, the site of the late President Lyndon B. Johnson Ranch. The area is high in elevation, 1,650 feet, and it's surrounded by cedar and oak. The weather is on the cool side. It averages 63 degrees in the summer and 47 in the winter. One-third of the residents are retired, and they initiate most of the area's cultural activities. The medical facilities are modern, and the nearest big city is San Antonio, which, despite the presence of skyscrapers, has a small-town atmosphere. They go on, they point out some places. I said to you the other day that, you know, if you're living on a small retirement income, you ought to consider leaving the United States and moving to Costa Rica, Mexico, or to some Eastern European country. Maybe, you know, if you're Polish and you speak Polish and you go to Poland, you know, you'd fit right in. You can live there for half or less what you can live for here in the United States. You go down to Lake Chapala in Mexico and you'll live on about one-tenth what you live here. If you got $800 a month coming from Social Security, that'd be equal to $8,000 a month here in the United States. So, you know, if you stop and think a little bit, you know, yeah, maybe you don't want to live in Mexico. Well, okay. $800 a month, where are you going to live in the United States? You know, tuck it away in your heart and see what comes up. Then they go on to travel and recreation. So I'll circle off estate planning over here. 23 things in travel and recreation. How to save money when you're traveling. The other day, a guy asked me this question. He said, what did it cost you on this Texas trip down here? What did this cost you down here to rent this hotel? Now, I had to have a meeting room in the hotel, and I had to have three rooms. And we were quoted prices that ranged from $2,200 to $8,500. That's right, $2,200 to $8,500. Well, naturally, we selected the $2,200, didn't we? If it would do the job, why would I want to pay $8,500 to do what $2,200 would do? And the guy was interested. Well, how did you get them down from $8,500? Well, first of all, that hotel didn't quote $8,500. They quoted about double. But you can just about figure that the hotel is going to quote you the prices in their on-season. Even if it's the off-season, they're going to quote you the prices that they charge in their on-season. Here locally, a motel charged one of my students $75 a night. And I told the student, I said, normally around here, it's around $30 to $40 a night. He got charged about double. And when we told the hotel lady down there about it, she says, well, that was over the Labor Day weekend. And then that Labor Day weekend is the on season. So one of the things that we do is we plan our activities around the off season. The off season. In other words, if you're in San Antonio, Texas, and this is at the middle of some big festival that they're having down there, or up here around in our area here, around the bass fishing tournament weekend or something like that. Hell, every motel room is rented out. Every motel room is a top dollar, and there's no reason for you to be conducting your school at that time. So what you do is you call around, you find out, well, when's the off season? Ask the Chamber of Commerce in San Antonio, where's the off season? When are your big festivals? You get all the big festivals down, everything is going to be sky high. When you get to the off season, that's when there's no tourists, and that's when there's nobody else in town. That's when you want to schedule your school in the off season. That's what we do. That's where we get the best hotel rates, which is the best for our students. Do our students want to come and do this at the middle of some bass tournament when it costs you $75 a night? Or do you want to do it in the off season when it costs you $30 a night? You know, just common sense tells you. Now, they got a section in here, how to travel free. There are hundreds of budget guides that tell you how to cut costs on trips. Many of these books contain low-cost travel tips, but they don't give you the ultimate scoop on no-cost travel. Instead of traveling cheap, you could be traveling free, from transportation by air or sea to lodgings, meals, and entertainment. Most free travel requires no special skills, no special credentials, no special contacts, and it can be just as luxurious and often more pleasurable than the most expensive paid vacation. Hey, I got to tell you a little story here. I went over to Hawaii some years back, and I don't know the name of the hotel, but it was one of those hotels on Waikiki, you know, one of those 20-story models, you know, there's about 5 or 10 of them down there. It was in one of those 20-story models. My wife prepared this trip in advance, and she got us into the Ambassador Suite on the 21st or 22nd floor. The only other more expensive suite was the penthouse on top called the Presidential Suite. Well, there's four of them on the floor below. I think it was the 21st floor, four of those. And those rent for $600 a night. The Ambassador Suite in this hotel rents for $600 a night. And she got it for, if I remember this right, it was $88. It was under $100 a night, well, plus tax. So it was about $100 a night. Now, you know, we don't often stay in $100 a night hotels, although today, you know, $100 a night is pretty common. But at that time, you know, we would have been looking more at $35 or $40, and for, you know, double that, we could stay in the Ambassador Suite. So we did. But it was the off-season, in the off-season. And she negotiated that. You know, she got him on the phone. Well, when's your off-season? And I think it was in January, if I remember. I forgot now exactly. Or maybe it was July. I forgot now if it's summer or winter over there. But whatever their off-season is. And that's when we scheduled our school, and that's when we went over there. Now, it wasn't quite free. And the travel over there now was pretty inexpensive. We went over there and back, two of us, now, two seats on a 747 from Chicago to Honolulu, $600 round trip. Now, that's pretty cheap. And the other day I got a promo out of the Carnival Cruise Lines over here, and they said that, I forgot exactly what the number was, but it was something like $175 for a 3-day Carnival cruise. It was right after one of those hurricanes, and they weren't selling very many tickets. They didn't have very many seats to sell. So you know, they're sending out these promotions. Now, this is the time for you to take your Carnival cruise. You know, when there's just been a hurricane and they're in their off season and they don't have any customers, and now's the time for you to take that trip. Now, that's the way we've done that over the years. And, you know, a trip to Hawaii, you know, might be a little bit pricey. But you save your money, you pay cash, and then when the deal comes up, you take advantage of it. Now, there are complimentary cruises. Like, cruise lines generally offer a free passage to anyone who recruits 10 to 15 paying passengers. Many airlines offer similar deals. Did you know that? Now, if you can't lure that many customers, you can get a prorated reduction on your fare. And you can also cruise free as an expert in a pertinent subject. Now, stop and think about this. You go out here and you act as a salesman, and you get the information from Carnival Cruises, and then you go to your church or your club or something like that and say, hey, listen, if we can get 15 people here, we can get this price on a Carnival cruise. And get this, if you can sell this, you get the Carnival cruise free for putting the 15 guys together from your church, your lodge, or your club. Have you ever heard of that before? Historians, anthropologists, naturalists, and ornithologists are in especially high demand. Your job on the cruise would be to present a series of lectures and to be available for informal questioning. It helps to have a PhD, or at least a master's, and have published articles on the subject, but an affable personality and a willingness to share your knowledge with others can stretch your credentials. After your first cruise in this capacity, a good reference will ease the way by other lines. You know, now I haven't tried this yet, but you know, I could do this. I could say, no, look, kids, would you like to do a carnival cruise for a week? And while we're on this weekend, 1 week cruise, we'll do a school. Well, listen, the Carnival cruise line over there doesn't cost any more than the hotel in Amarillo, Texas, for crying out loud. You know, that cruise is $600. You want to spend the $600 in a land-based deal, or should we go on the Carnival cruise and to be out at sea while we're doing the school? And meanwhile, if I can recruit enough of you to do that, you get a discount for all of the guys you bring, plus you get free for the guy that puts it together. Now, why don't you think about doing something like that? And then they got little travel tips in here like cheaper, better, faster flying, and free foreign tours, and great cooking school vacations. Don't call hotel 800 numbers. You know, when you're making room reservations, here's the reason. Hotel room rates change daily, and the reservation agent, who is usually not at the hotel, may not have the lowest, latest, best rate. It's better to call the hotel directly and mention if you're a member of any organization that offers special discounts. If all else fails, request the hotel's corporate rate, usually available to anyone who asks. This is often 5 to 10% off the published rack rate. That's right. You want the corporate rate, and then you want the senior citizen's discount, which is 10%. So you get the corporate 10%, you get the senior citizen 10%, and get this. We often book schools for hotels. So I like to go to Reno, Nevada, because I can stay at Squaga's Nugget. And they've got a catering service there that caters to groups and organizations. And if you've got a group or an organization, and you call a Squaga's Nugget in Reno, Nevada, and you put your group in there, they've, you know, the $100 rooms, they give them to you for half price. They give them to you for $50. You know, if you can't afford the $100 room, you stay in the $50, it costs you $25. They figure they're going to make it on the gambling. There's nothing that requires that you gamble. They just figure that human nature will take its course. That's why I like those gambling resorts. If you can stay off the tables, you can go to the shows, and you can stay in the hotel, and you can get the meeting room, and all of that is pretty cheap. You get it for half price or less. So that's the way we do it. That's the way they're giving you these ideas here in the book. Remember the book, Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. Trade Secrets, Facts You're Not Supposed to Know. You can probably get a copy of it at Barnes & Noble. It's from Boardrooms Incorporated. Hey, we're about out of time again, and a little girl came down, signaled me that breakfast is ready, so I think I'll quit right here and remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Okay, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.